Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. No squigonometry today, but we will begin by getting dusty and blowing a lot of hot air. Then we're going to be treated to about the longest, most delicious charcuterie board on the planet. At 10, we'll let all that digest during open phones, and then we'll finish up back at the trough, or in this case, the Big Picture Farm in Townsend, sampling cheese, caramels, chocolates, and a few other goat milk goodies. But first, we're off to Post Mills, part of the Thetford Metroplex. We're going to spend the next half hour perusing the many interesting items the late Brian Boland accumulated during his life. All the fun stuff resides at the Experimental Balloon and Airship Museum, also known as Brian's Museum, of rusty, dusty stuff. And joining us to lead the tour is Tina Foster. Tina, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. We hope to also be joined by Jordan Long, but so far we've not been able to locate Jordan. So, Tina, you're in charge. Listeners, to ask our guests about the Experimental Balloon and Airship Museum, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255, and you can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. If you stopped into the museum and like to share your thoughts of what you saw, you can call or email. Tina, the Brian of Brian's Rusty Dusty Things is the late Brian Boland. So tell us about this man.
Well, I wish Jordan were here because he actually knew Brian long before I did when he was growing up in Connecticut. He knew him as a young child. I met Brian after moving here to Thetford from California a number of years ago. And Brian was an incredibly creative and inventive person whose passion was lighter-than-air aviation. He built over 160 balloons and airships. He was very inventive, pioneered a lot of different stuff, and was just known for his devotion to experimental aviation. Amazing builder and visions. You know, he'd just sort of wake up in the morning and say, "Let's build a dinosaur." And so we build a dinosaur, you know.
Yes,
so
you would.
Really an amazing individual who was lucky enough to be able to spend most of his life doing what he really loved.
You know? How did he build these airships, Tina?
Well, he built his first balloon as really as an art project when he was at Pratt studying art in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
And he really built it as an inflatable sculpture on a little Singer sewing machine in a tiny apartment out of sort of the nylon that you make windbreakers out of, I think.
Right.
But it managed, you could inflate it, and he did. And I think he sort of got in a harness to try flying and was completely hooked. And so after teaching art for a number of years, his kids in his classes sort of provoked him to show him this balloon he'd made. And he put them to work making another one and continued to build them. So basically, you get a whole lot of fabric, and ideally, you have a good industrial sewing machine, and you start piecing these things together. Obviously, you have to plan out, you know, sort of what the pieces are that you're going to cut and how you're going to put them together. But a lot of fabric and a lot of work and a lot of time in the sewing machine, and Jordan could certainly tell you about that as he was sort of walked through making his first balloon by Brian and has built has had that experience.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, what is this museum that you have there in Post Mills?
So the museum is basically houses a lot of the stuff that Brian had collected over the years. He would tell a story about going off to college and coming home and discovering that his mother had gotten rid of all of his stuff. So he must have been a collector his whole life. And he was determined that would never happen again.
Yeah.
And living in Connecticut, I've seen the house where he lived there that was a very modest little cape that by the time he moved out of it had probably tripled in size and had trees growing through the roof and, you know, all kinds of places for all kinds of things. And when he bought the airport here in Post Mills, one of the attractions is airplane hangars are great places to store things and also a lot of room. And so over the years, he expanded the living space to have a room for cutting out balloons for, you know, with a big long table to cut out the fabric. And then next to that, he built basically a big, long sort of shoebox-shaped structure with two floors into which he could begin moving this collection of old cars. And it's sort of like a retirement home for balloons, so many, many balloon envelopes that are no longer functional, a whole variety of different types of balloon baskets, outboard motors, derelict vehicles, burned-up fire engines. I mean, you name it. There's kind of everything in here.
Was it intended to be a museum, or did Brian just accumulate enough stuff that it kind of morphed itself into one?
No, he had all of this. He had much of the stuff and built the building specifically to house it.
Yeah. I take it you enjoy going up in hot air balloons.
Yes.
All right. And explain to people what that experience is like, because it's not exactly what you expect, is it, when you first go up?
Yeah, I don't know what people's visions are of ballooning. I had been ballooning a couple different places before I met Brian, but having met him and sort of been the chase crew, the person who follows you while you're up in the balloon, the person on the ground in a vehicle who's coming to pick you up at the end, and having worked with Brian for so long, I have a real appreciation for it. I never personally would want to be a balloon pilot because I really right. like to be able to steer things, and you really can't do that in a balloon.
No, you can't.
But the whole experience really starts with, you know, sort of laying out the balloon and seeing this sort of, you know, you open a bag and pull out this, you know, huge thing of fabric that's just lying there flat on the ground, and then it gets inflated, usually using a fan, and it, you know, it begins to inflate. It puffs up with air, and then there's a very powerful burner that's used to heat the air, and then the balloon sort of stands up, and it goes from this thing that, you know, was in this little bag that was maybe 3 feet across to a structure that might be standing 80 or 90 feet in the air. And you climb in the basket, and there's a lot of noise when the burner's going. They're pretty right. noisy, and up you go. And the sense of ascent is so gentle. And then when you're up there floating and the burner's not on, it's incredibly quiet and right. peaceful. You see things from a really different perspective, and it's just really, really lovely.
I've always described it because the one thing that you don't realize till you're up is there's no wind because you're going with the mm-hmm. wind. And the other thing is it almost feels like you're just hanging out in the atmosphere and the world is moving underneath you. You feel mm-hmm. like you're not moving because this absence of wind, and it is a really special feeling. Now, you mentioned the chase crew. Brian mm-hmm. Brian has created some baskets that wouldn't have required a chase crew.
Right. That was one of his quests, I yeah. think. He loved ballooning. He would balloon every possible slot that he could. So he would actually fly a fair amount by himself. And so one of the challenges, if you go by yourself and you don't have a chase crew, is how are you going to get home? So he did a number of things like, you know, take a bicycle with him or take an electric motor scooter with him, sort of hanging off the basket. But we had a period where he was very interested in building these three-wheeled sort of super fuel-efficient vehicles, which were basically constructed out of motor scooters that were cut in half and then rejoined to make a three-wheeled vehicle. And we built a number with the intention, so they were built with frames so that they could clip into a hot air balloon, and you would be able to go flying and land and then drive back. I think we took one of them to the Stoke Car Meet one year and launched from the, you know, the fairgrounds there, yeah. the meeting grounds there, and flew, and then were able to drive back. And I think we even took it in the little vehicle, you know, parade that they do at Stoke.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's fantastic. Tina, how did Brian acquire the rusty and dusty stuff that has found its way into this wonderful place?
Well, driving with Brian was always a very interesting experience because you would be driving and suddenly you'd hear, stop, wait, turn around, go back, you know. So he had a very good eye yep. and was constantly spotting things from the side of the road that looked interesting or abandoned. And he did the same thing from the air. He might see something from above that looked interesting to him, a really cool old abandoned car or something. So he was just really good at seeing things. And, you know, he'd frequent, you know, the you know, sort of swap shop at the recycling center or other places. And he would somehow just often accumulate a lot of things. Like at one point, he just started picking up abandoned crutches, because there's a lot of abandoned crutches around if you start looking. And his friends said, O'Brien's picking up abandoned crutches, we'll get some too. And now we have a crutch sculpture in the museum that's composed of probably hundreds of these old abandoned crutches that sort of, you know, goes up through the museum and flies out the front window. So he just always had his eyes open for cool stuff. And then once you have a place like this, people decide that you might want to have their weird, cool stuff when they're getting rid of it. So we have, for example, it was basically a homemade submarine that a guy was building to use to go explore the bottom of Lake Erie. He never quite got it finished. And when he died, his wife thought, oh, well, maybe the Museum of Rusty Stuff needs this. So Brian made a road trip out and brought back this strange little sort of capsule. So we have things that sort of show up in the museum. People bring stuff and just leave it, you know.
It becomes the repository for all things wonderful. Let's head to East Corinth and speak with Forbes. Good morning, Forbes.
Yeah, it's me again. I had the opportunity to speak to Brian one time before his tragic demise, and I had always wondered how they changed directions with the balloons, and he explained to me that the air currents flow at different elevations. They flow in different directions, so you could pick a different elevation and pick up an airstream carrying you north, south, or east, west, or whatnot. I thought that was pretty interesting.
And to change elevations, you either, Tina, you can correct me. I think you either add air to the balloon or lets them out, right? You have that ability to kind of elevate or to decrease in elevation. Is that right,
Tina? Technically, you're heating the air that's in the balloon, and then particularly when you're landing, you may open a little vent. There's like a little parachute top on the balloon, and you may vent a little air out to help you descend. So you're either heating, or sometimes just letting the balloon cool off on its own will help you to descend a little bit. But we're absolutely right about the wind being different at different levels. And something that is a phenomenon people may not know about is that sometimes when you come into land, there's a certain amount of spitting over the side of the balloon involved so that you can see which way your spit is going to go as you get closer to the ground and know which way the balloon's going to go.
I was not asked to do that on my few balloon rides, thank goodness.
Usually that's the pilot's responsibility, I think.
Is there something in the museum that always brings a smile to your face when you see it, Tina?
Oh, there's a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
There's a Link Trainer, which is one of the first flight simulators that was ever built. Mm. And we have one again. Somebody donated it to us. And it's just this very cool little fabric-covered, rather delicate device that was built by a guy who tried to sell it to the Air Force here, and they really weren't interested. So it wasn't until many years later that they actually began using them as flight simulators to help teach people how to fly when they couldn't see anything. But it's like this funny little airplane-shaped box, so I love that. There's a very cool, ancient Ural motorcycle that Brian used to, you know, tour around England when he was there one year with either a friend or his balloon in the sidecar. There's a very pretty little replica of a Newport 17, like a World War I aircraft that's just kind of perfect and lovely, all kinds of things.
And when is the museum open? Is it open to the public certain hours? How do people come and see it?
We don't have sort of standard opening hours, so and it is a private museum, so we do ask that people have permission to go in.
Okay.
What we've been doing recently, it's a little different. Brian was usually here in the past all the time, and I have a job, so I'm not here all the time. But I do ask that people give us a call at the airport. The number is 802-333-9254, and just let us know when they might be dropping by. And that way I have a little chance to kind of orient people and also know that people are coming in. If somebody happens to stop by, you're welcome to ring the bell outside the living space and see if anyone's here. And even if you're not able to go in, there are some big Dutch doors with big windows, and so you can pretty much see everything that's on the first floor of the museum, even without going into the museum itself.
Beautiful. And there is the wooden dinosaur out there. But
yes.
Don't get too close, right?
Yes, we do have the Vermontosaurus, which is slowly, slowly settling to Earth. But she's had a bunch of babies. That's probably why her belly's lying on the ground now. And she has. So we have several wooden dinosaur constructions, and also the vehicle shed with the three-wheeled vehicles is right across from the museum and open, available for people to see, and has some nice little information about each of the vehicles in the building process.
Let's head to Barry now. Talk to Flint. Good morning, Flint. Go right ahead. How are you there? Let's give him one more shot, Flint.
There we go. I'm here. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
I think it's really wonderful that you have Tina Foster on. Tina, I have a friend of mine named Brian Kobelars, who lives down in Connecticut. I think it's Farmington. Apparently, at one point, Brian Boland taught high school.
Yes, he was the art teacher at Farmington High School, I think, right, for about 7 years.
Yeah, and what's so weird is that while he was down there, Brian actually flew a balloon that he built and with Brian's connivance, apparently, and it was quite an experience. My friend, he is now a videographer, and I'm trying to coax him to come. He's had a lot of health problems, but I'm trying to coax him to come down and take a shot of the museum. I know there's some wonderful video on, particularly there's a nice thing about Brian Boland on YouTube, so I recommend anybody see it. He was an amazing engineer. His three-wheel contraptions. He is a man who shouldn't be allowed to touch wicker. All right. Well, thank you, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks,
really,
Flint.
A good thing.
Oh, what a beautiful call. That's really great to hear, Tina. Tell us about the Post Mills Airport. What kind of things go on there?
Well, we have a number of planes that live here. It's a grass strip airport. And we have a very active glider club, so I don't know how many gliders exactly live here, but quite a few, and a tow plane. And so on weekends, it's kind of fun to come down and watch them. They're taking off, you know, every few minutes and taking a glider up. The club does a lot of instruction, so there's some students taking flights. So that's one of the main things that goes on, and, you know, then people fly in and visit, and every once in a while a helicopter stops by or some people with powered parachutes. I can just hear somebody starting up the lawnmower outside. I don't know if any of you heard that, but we have a big 11-foot-wide lawnmower, and so there's a lot of mowing that goes into keeping your grass strip airport in good shape.
It's like a golf course.
And then we do have our Experimental Balloon and Airship Association annual meet every year in May. And that is, it's limited to home-built and experimental balloons and airships. So pretty much everybody who brings a balloon built that balloon themselves or knows the person who built it. And we generally get about 30 to 40 different balloons that come and fly. We have some folks who do some food for lunch and dinner. And it's a really great opportunity. It's free. We have free parking. People can come and watch the balloons take off, talk with the people who built them and the people who fly them, and just kind of enjoy this kind of really special place.
It is a special place. You know, when I've gone to Thetford and I've seen Post Mills, and you drive over to Post Mills and there's this wonderful airport, you're like, oh, my gosh, this is a real great Vermont find, a wonderful place to visit. Tina Foster, I want to thank you so much for telling us about the Experimental Balloon and Airship Museum, also known as Brian's Museum of Rusty Dusty Stuff, and, of course, about Brian Boland. Thank you so much, Tina.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Have a great day. We're going to take a break for CBS News and then take the wonderful trip from farm to cheese. And coming up today at 1, we've got the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. That's followed by 120 minutes of music with Daring Dan Cardozo. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. A few weeks ago, I stopped into the Blue Paddle Bistro in South Hero, and one of the owners, Mandy Hotchkiss, mentioned that they were going to have a special event with a charcuterie board that was 8 or 10 or something feet long. As much as it was another great reason to get back to the paddle, I was really excited to see this supersized charcuterie board or grazing table. And I arrived early, and people were circling it with awe and reverence. I'm not lying. And then the creators of this incredible culinary presentation got up to tell us a little bit about it. The company was called Farm to Cheese. Best name ever, right? And the same can be said for the charcuterie board. Of course, I had to track down Farm to Cheese for you to know about it. So joining me now are the owners. We have Tiffany Cunningham. Tiffany, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And also Laura Allen. Laura, I'm glad you're here as well.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Happy to be here.
Oh, great. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Tiffany and Laura about Farm to Cheese and about charcuterie creation, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tiffany, what is Farm to Cheese?
Yeah, I'd love to tell you about it. So it's a newer company where we actually create charcuterie boards. Here, example, you said grazing tables, which are intended to serve more than 10 or so people. And then we also do cheese pairing classes. But I'd love to kick it over to Laura to actually talk about the mission of the company.
Sure.
Because she talks about it really well.
Good.
Yeah, so thanks. Yeah, so we really are here to promote the farms of Vermont and keep them sustainable, healthy, and alive. And because we know those are just so integral to everything that we love about Vermont, right? And if our farms go away, then Vermont's landscape looks really different. So that's really kind of our overarching mission, is to help to keep these cheesemakers and the farms sustainable now and for the future. And so what we do is try to promote the amazing cheesemakers that we have in Vermont, truly some world-class cheesemakers, and keep them vibrant by, promoting their products. So really that's at the core of everything that we do. And not only are we promoting cheese, but we're promoting everything that is made in Vermont, because we have some amazing artisanal producers here as well. So we have a local honey maker that we partner with. We have a local charcuterie maker who out of Waitsfield. So we're always interested in trying to support everything Vermont.
Well, I'm going to ask you both this, but Laura, keep going. Tell us about your background pre-Farm to Cheese.
Sure. So I have very little cheese knowledge. Tiffany is really the cheese expert here. Mm-hmm. I'm the Vermont lover, frankly. And so it's going to be a kind of a great blend of the two. Of Tiffany brings about 15 plus years of cheese experience and from various different backgrounds. She's originally from Texas. And I've been in Vermont for about 13 or so years. And we just want to keep, promoting Vermont cheese and everything about it. So she was kind of doing some cheese classes in Austin, Texas, and I was just thinking, oh my goodness, why don't we have anything like that here? So it's been kind of a great blending of the two passions of ours, her, the cheese passion, and me, the Vermont passion. And that's really kind of how Farm to Cheese came to be.
Tiffany, tell us more about your cheese background.
Yeah. So as Laura mentioned, I have about 15 years experience in the cheese industry. And initially it started as a cheesemonger at Whole Foods Market in Austin, Texas, working behind the counter, cutting cheese, selling cheese, all that stuff for about 12 years. And then I actually was able to work for I was the assistant to the global cheese buyer at Whole Foods, which really exposed me to just so many different wonderful cheeses. And every cheesemonger knows that Vermont is actually the place that you want to be, because that they make the best cheese in the world, or some of the best cheese in the world. Mm-hmm. And So I did that, and then I also worked at a little shop called Antonelli's in Austin, Texas, and that's where I taught those cheese pairing classes. But I also had the opportunity to gain a certification in cheese. So I am a certified cheese professional by the American Cheese Society. That is a real thing.
I'm impressed.
Thank you. Yeah, they only offer it once a year. They only offer that test once a year. So I was lucky enough to be part of the first class that ever got that certification and just kind of take my love from there.
And Tiffany, who gets credit for coming up with the most excellent name of a company, and how'd that happen?
That would be Laura. She came up with that. Yep. And, you know, really we were just kicking around names and nothing really stuck. Laura, how did you come up with it?
I think it was just born out of the idea of trying to keep the farms at the forefront of both our mission and values, and trying to figure out different ways that we can celebrate them through our business.
Well, Laura, I've talked about the grazing table, but that's not all you offer. What other sizes, from smallest to largest, of the charcuterie presentations that you guys create?
Sure. So we are hitting a bunch of farmers markets this summer. So at the farmers markets and other events, food truck nights, all sorts of local events, we offer a charcuterie box. So a great little 7x7 box, picnic type box, that you can kind of take to go. And it has all of our wonderful charcuterie and cheese offerings inside, along with, you know, dried fruits, fresh fruit, a variety of things. We have four different size charcuterie boards that we offer. I actually make the boards myself. So it is Vermont in all of the ways. And then we have the grazing tables that you've mentioned. And then starting very soon, in the next week, we are doing cheese pairing classes. And those can either be done at a private party for a private event, or they are done at we have one next week that is at Von Trapp's farmstead out in Wakefield, right on the farm, right where the cheese is made. And then we are in various other locations doing our cheese pairing classes. So those are kind of the core services that we provide.
I love the idea of a charcuterie box. I'm thinking of when I travel, like in England, and you have what is called a plowman's lunch, and it's just it's not heavy, and you're just able to pick at these wonderful things. I can see that, you know, what a perfect thing to pick up and grab and take with you as you're traveling about seeing this wonderful state. Tiffany, how much input do you get from the client who's hiring you to make one of those grazing tables?
Yeah, I mean, really we give them the choice and option of how much control they want there. You know, oftentimes they let us kind of take creativity and make all the choices with that. But I do ask questions of what are your favorite cheeses? What do you not like? You know, what should I just avoid at all costs? Like, some people just don't like blue cheese, although I encourage them to continue trying it.
That's right.
But most of the time, it's us with that creative license of coming up with the cheeses that go with that. What's in season? What's tasting really good right now? What do we know that pairs really well with these? So it's a lot of fun for us. You know, there's a lot of taste testing happening in our home and having a lot of fun figuring out what works.
Yeah. I love those people who don't like blue cheese, because that means more for the rest of us who do. Now, Laura, let's begin with kind of the basic ingredients that are almost must-haves on one of your charcuterie boards.
Sure. I just want to touch on that for a minute. I was one of those people that thought they didn't like blue cheese until I truly had Vermont blue cheese. Yeah. And now I have been converted into a blue cheese lover. So I think that is a major part of our mission as well, is to really try to expose people to different things, maybe things they thought they didn't previously like. I also thought I knew what good cheese was until I met Tiffany and she exposed me to truly what good cheese was. But what goes on a charcuterie board? Variety of things. I think, we partner with Lake Hill Preserve, so we always have jam on our board of various kinds. We always have fresh fruit on the board. We have nuts,
dried fruit, various types of crackers. And then our cheese that we put on the board is always different. So it's going to be rare that you would ever get the same charcuterie board, charcuterie box, any of our offerings. It's rare that you're going to get the same cheese on it necessarily. So we try to kind of keep it fresh. We keep it interesting, you know, specifically for the grazing tables and the boards. A lot of it, too, is presentation. So we work hard at not only providing you quality ingredients, but providing you something that looks really pretty, because that is part of it.
Yeah, it is gorgeous to see this when it's set up. Tiffany, what are some of the more, I'll say, exotic items you might place on a board if you know the client is more adventurous than most?
Well, I mean, blue cheese is about as adventurous as it gets.
Okay.
So, but there are differing, there's varying levels of strength when it comes to blue cheese. So I like intentionally put and kind of like entry level blue cheese on the last one, but we can get really strong with that one. But if the customer is particularly adventurous, I get what's called a washed rind cheese. Those are like your more stinky aromatic cheeses.
Yeah.
But they taste so buttery and delicious once you actually get into. You get past the stinkiness in the rind and you actually taste the cheese. It is just amazing. So that's probably the two that I, those are my go-tos when people like strong cheeses.
Nice. Laura, what kind of occasions do people usually hire you for to make these?
Great question. So we do everything from weddings to funerals, any kind of large gatherings, celebrations, right? So fun to be a part of Blue Paddle Bistro's celebration of being the best restaurant outside of Chittenden County and best chef outside of Chittenden County. So that was just so fantastic. So truly anything. Again, we'll do private parties, birthdays, anything where there's a large gathering. We also are happy to be at business events. So we've talked to a few businesses and leaders of large departments to be a part of any of those kind of gatherings. So truly anything. We're happy to go anywhere and be a part of these kind of events.
And Laura, the grazing tables, what kind of advance notice do you need to create one? You know, say I wanted an 8-foot grazing table for next Thursday.
Sure. Ideally, perfect world, you know, 2 weeks would be ideal. But, you know, always feel free to give us a call. And we have usually a lot of cheese on hand. So if we can make something happen within that 2 weeks, we're happy to do so. So we actually have a grazing table tomorrow that they just reached out to us this past weekend.
Wow.
So, yeah, so 2 weeks is ideal, but always happy to try to make something happen if needed.
I forget that you have to have all that stuff on hand. It doesn't just exist. Tiffany, it is an honest-to-goodness work of art. So who's the esthetician between you that makes sure the presentation is appealing to the eye? Because, well, like I said, when people showed up at Blue Paddle, they were – I don't know if you watched, but people were just kind of walking around, taking it in. It was eye candy to begin with before it was a special treat to the palate.
Yeah, that's funny. I think people were like, we don't actually want to eat it.
Yeah,
it looks so good.
That's right.
Definitely encourage them to go in there and eat it. So that's a good question. Between the two of us, Laura is definitely the esthetician when it comes to making things look good and pretty. We work really well together where my side of things is, you know, I'm going to work on crafting the pairings, you know, with her help as well. But crafting the cheeses, the pairings, cutting the cheese, all that kind of stuff. And then her creativity kind of shines when it comes to actually placing it on the board and or on the table. And we actually like do a map of what we want it to look like. And so it's very intentional about how we line it up and, you know, what surrounds it. We actually absolutely consider what to place around it, knowing that most folks are going to grab from that same area. So typically, you know, what is near it will actually pair really well with it. And we take a lot of time and care into placing things and making it look good.
There's like a yellow brick road of cheese running up the middle. But you just brought up a great point, Tiffany. You made an announcement before people did start loading up their plates about the proximity of items to one another. Laura, this is not some slapdash arrangement. Explain what you try to do as, you know, people walk along this grazing table.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that is the piece of our business that really tries to set us apart from others, is really that pairing piece. And this is where Tiffany's expertise really shines of, you know, you may love that specific cheese, but you never thought about putting it with a cornichon or trying it with a chocolate raspberry spread. So, you know, really exposing people to different pairings. We have one of our taglines is the journey to the perfect bite. And really, we kind of live by that, you know, of every board, every grazing table, you know, you might be introduced to a different pairing that you've never tried before. And maybe it brings out different flavors of the cheese that you've just never experienced. So it's very intentional. As Tiffany mentioned, you know, we provide a lot of information on that grazing table as well, to not only tell you about the cheese, where it came from, what kind of cheese it is, but what that potential perfect bite for you might be. So we try to be very intentional about how we put together both the boards and the grazing tables.
I was very intentional then on how I laid out my plate. Ooh, that came near this, so I'm going to keep that over here together. I really did, and it was fabulous. Tiffany, how do you source the items that go on the charcuterie boards and grazing tables you do?
Yeah, I really like this question. Thank you. So we partner with 6 specific farms here in Vermont to source our cheeses, and we go directly to the farms. So we work with Jasper Hill Farms, Shelburne Farms, Blue Ledge, Von Trapp, Cobb Hill Farmstead, and then also Vermont Shepherd. And then we also kind of, you know, the fun for us is that we get to kind of find what we like the most ingredient-wise and try to bring them onto the table. So really it's like what do we enjoy? And then we want to share that with our customers. So we also work with Blake Hill Preserves, Babette's Table for our charcuterie, and then also Ariel's Honey Infusions at the moment. Looking to expand that, you know, if the right product comes to us. But as far as the other ingredients that accompany what we call kind of like the highlight of the focus of the grazing table, is we just get creative and actually have a little fun. I mean, for me, I've had 15 years experience of trying unique things. And along the way, people have encouraged me to try pairings that I wouldn't normally have tried, but ended up really enjoying. So I just kind of keep that in my back pocket and hopefully introduce more folks to that. But really, it's just kind of like, what would we like to have? Let's get creative and then try it. And if it works, then we share it.
Well, I got to ask you a question. There was this green olive. It was bright green. And a lot of time when I get away from those jarred olives, you know, the olives can be hard and a little bland. But this was amazing. What was that olive? What did I eat? It was so good. I want it.
One of my favorites as well. It's called a Castelvetrano, and it is a younger olive. So it's actually bright green. So the more you age or cure an olive, the darker it's going to get. So the bright greenness speaks to how young it is. So it's going to taste more like an olive oil, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Buttery. So very different than any other olive you might have had. It still has a little bit of that salty brine that I personally really enjoy in an olive, but that undertone of buttery, like just olive oil, right, is really the best way to explain that. Not only does it taste great, but I think it looks really good. So that's like a fun way to enjoy it.
It was absolutely memorable for me. Castelvetrano olives. I will hunt them down. Thank you so much. Tiffany Cunningham and Laura Allen are the owners of Farm to Cheese. To learn more about what they do, you can visit farmtocheese.com. Laura and Tiffany, I want to thank you for making the world a more delicious place and for being on the show this morning. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News for an update, and then we'll open up the phones until 10:30. And the Sox are in the Steel City for Game 2 of their 3-game series with the Pirates. Our coverage commences at 6:05. First Heave is at 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Okay, Danny, grab that massive lever in the control room, swing it into the open position. The phones are now open at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK. And Danny, also please open the email portal at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. New feature. We have a house band now. Bill LaBeouf and the Bold Vikings covering Blondie's Call Me. Yep. All right. We just talked farm to cheese. So my next guest after open phones is the Big Picture Farm in Townsend. They make goat cheese. I attended the Vermont Cheese Summit on Sunday at Shelburne Farms. I'll share more on that. But let us know about some special cheeses that the rest of us should be into. Or butters. Oh, my. Vermont has some outstanding butters, too. As a matter of fact, I keep forgetting that I'm good on butter at home. And lately, when I'm at the store and I see another one that I like, I act like I'll never see it again. Needless to say, my freezer right now has become a little butter storehouse. But any butters you really digging? And all the amazing tourist traffic in Vermont, where are you telling your guests they must visit when they get here? Please share. Of course, you can also go off the board for a subject of your own choosing. You can call us at 802-244-1777 or 877-291-TALK or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, we're going to start with the Duke of Newbury, a Duke without portfolio. Your Grace, Fred.
Very good.
Thank you.
Hey, you know, this is very interesting.
Okay.
I've been trying to find out this, you know, this drug business, illegal drug business. And went to Google and there's no luck at Google. So maybe you know more about it than they do. So anyways, can you tell me what the street value means? You know, they talk about the street value of drug is $45,000.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, I would imagine, so it's just like retail and wholesale. I'm going to explain it in those terms.
That's exactly right. And the interesting thing about retail and wholesale is the drug cartels, they're not in the retail business.
Right.
They're in the wholesale business. So they're in the wholesale business. So this street value is nothing more than the fancy algebra that the DEA came up with.
Well, not necessarily. So, Fred, I'm a man who took microeconomics and macroeconomics and can tell you that micro is the small one and macro is the big one. I would imagine that even in something illicit, like dealing drugs on the street, there are economic principles at play here, right? And prices wouldn't be necessarily advertised, but you would know, right? And so let's say you're dealing on that corner and I'm dealing on this corner, and I can give you a bag of something for $10 where you're charging $12. When people find out that I got a same product for $10 that you're charging $12 for, you know, I'll get more action.
Yeah, but
so I would imagine there are economic principles at play.
The problem with that is the most dangerous part of the drug business is the retail business. The drug cartels aren't in the retail business.
No, they aren't.
They're in the wholesale business.
That's correct.
They're in the wholesale business.
Right.
So the whole wholesale business is easy. They bring up, in other words, it costs them probably $1,000 for a kilo to make a kilo of uh, cocaine or whatever it is.
Okay.
But once they get it to the, border, the price goes up to say $3,000. So they've made their $3,000, and this street value is nothing more than fancy algebra because the cartel has already made their money.
So, yeah, you
know, but I mean, this whole thing is a joke. I mean, all you have to do is go to Google and see if you can figure it out. And nobody can figure it out, neither can the DEA, because it's fancy algebra.
Well,
simple as that. And the cost of drugs, as far as the cartel is concerned, the cartel is the big buyer of drugs. In other words, there's all kinds of people in the Latin America that make drugs.
Right.
They're the manufacturers, and the cartel is the only buyer. And so if you're the only buyer, you set the price.
Well, and there have been times, too, I can remember where they'd bring in the poppies
cocoa
or whatever.
It's
cocoa leaves, yeah. And they'd process them. They'd have a plant in Brooklyn, New York, where they would bring it in and process it here, found it to be cheaper and, you know, easier to sneak through, process it in Brooklyn, and it was, you know, like a 9-to-5 plant. And then produce it there. But I'm going to disagree with you, Fred. You know, it's not a joke. I think, you know, in truth, there are economic principles at play in a free enterprise system, is what we have. And again, this is kind of the black market of a free enterprise system, but economic principles do indeed apply. Supply and demand, competition, things like that will affect the price that someone gets when they bring it in and a wholesale value, and when they move it on to their distributors and then on to the street. You know, somebody gets a profit along the way. And, you know, part of the problem is today in trying to increase their profits, things like fentanyl are mixed in with this drug, and that causes some severe problems. All right. I don't want to go too far into the drug trade. I don't know much about it, but somehow it persists, and it persists when there is a market, an end user, and as long as that happens, we continue to have that. All right. I'm going to get off the drugs, Fred, if you don't mind, and go on to the cheese. So I do want to tell you that over the weekend, Sunday, I got to attend the Vermont Cheese Summit. And when I say those three words, if you're a cheese lover, you start to – your head explodes. You start to shiver a little because it sounds like the most wonderful thing on earth. It was pared down. This is the first time they've held it out at Shelburne Farms, which, again, is just a beautiful place to visit if you've never gone, and a great place to send visitors from out of state. Shelburne Museum, obviously, Shelburne Farms also. Just two wonderful show places in Chittenden County that you can send people. But since this is the first one they've held since the pandemic, it was scaled down. And I got to reconnect with some cheesemakers who, you know, you've known through their product or I've had here on the show, the Triple Creme of Champlain Valley Creamery. If you've never tried it, it is a little nugget of wonderfulness. And then Stan from Mount Mansfield Creamery, who was on a few months ago, I just love the way he presents and talks about his cheeses. He wells up with pride as he cuts you a little piece of cheese. Here's the half pipe, and then he tells you all about it. He did invite me to come to their plant and to make cheese with him sometime. Oh, my gosh. That's like the apex, I think, for me of living in Vermont, is the day I get to go to Mount Mansfield Creamery and to actually make cheese. And I mentioned butters, too. One of my favorites on earth is made here in Vermont, Plowgate Creamery. Marissa makes fabulous butters. She has a new one I tried that has seaweed in it. If that's something you think you'd enjoy, you should probably make sure you grab one of those. She now has a deal, and we hope to have her on in the next several weeks when she has time, but with Meadowbrook Creamery down in Brattleboro, which is another great story. The Vermont cheese stories are really phenomenal. I'll run through some more if we have time after the break. But Meadowbrook Creamery started with just mozzarella made in the back of this great little Italian store in Manchester. And, you know, they'd have the balls of mozzarella up there, and the guy who made the cheese every once in a while would have to run the counter. And this woman comes in one day, and he waits on her, and she says, what if I wanted to buy about 2 dozen? And he said, yeah, I could have them for you. And she said, yeah, because I go down to Boston and work with specialty purveyors down there. I'd like to take some down. And it formed a partnership, and I don't even know what the numbers are today for Meadowbrook Dairy, but they have it's in the millions of dollars annually of sales there in North Brattleboro. Anyway, Plowgate Creamery is now working with them. That's great news. All right, we're going to take a break. The phones are open. Hop on. You want to talk cheese? You want to talk sightseeing? If you want to talk drug trade, I'll do my best. 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. There we go, the new theme music. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255 to join the open phone onslaught. You can email VTViewpoint at RadioVermont.com. Vermont cheeses, butters, points of interest. Yesterday we discussed Scrigonometry, and our good friend Forbes called in with a question. Well done, Forbes. But if you've got more questions about hyperellipses and super eggs, hey, now's the time. Our numbers are 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. And let's get to Barrytown and talk to Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, I got an Elvis story.
Oh, yes. Yesterday was the
45 years. 30, yeah.
Yeah, 45 years, right.
77, he passed away.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't told this story. I think I can do it in like 3 minutes.
Yeah, take your time.
When I was in college in Washington, D.C., after I left Barry, after high school, there was this Elvis two-day thing at the University of Maryland in the field house there,
yeah.
And it was two nights in a row. And so if you called into a radio station and you could sing like 10 seconds of an Elvis song, you got free tickets. So my campus girlfriend, when I was in college, was dead on Elvis. I mean, she just had to go. So I carried a transistor radio around to all my classes with an earplug.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of payphones around. So yeah. I would hear an Elvis song come on, and I'd have to be the number 5 caller or 3 or whatever.
Right.
So I tried really hard to get Elvis tickets. So I didn't get them. So the first Friday night he was at the University of Maryland there, my girlfriend and I, we decided to have a date out off campus. And she goes, let's drive out there anyway. Maybe we can just hear him from the outside of the auditorium.
Oh, yeah.
So we went there, and there's this guy standing outside the store, and he's got tickets. And so we go, okay, we're college students, so we get him down off his price. He was a scalper.
Yeah.
We go inside, and the ushers look at our tickets. They take us down, and they go, these are counterfeit tickets.
Oh.
So we're inside. Elvis is there with all the Jordanaires and Destiny's Child, the whole Vegas kind of show.
Oh my gosh.
This was a couple of years before he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So they let us stand off stage.
Oh.
I mean, we were so close to Elvis, we could see the sweat coming off his face. So the next day, my girlfriend, who's an Elvis freak, she goes, let's go back to the auditorium, and you know when they say Elvis has left a building? let's go to the underground garage and see the limo come out. So I'm going, okay. So we do. We go back the next night, and Elvis has left the building. The door opens up on the underground garage.
Yeah.
And there's like 100 people there. We're going to stop Elvis's limo. And most of these people are ladies, okay? And so my girlfriend's got a flash cube camera, a 110.
Mm-hmm.
So she's flashing pictures when Elvis's limo comes out.
Yeah.
And I'm going, so the limo wasn't going to stop for anybody.
Right.
It just kept barreling. So
the next day
it was Sunday. And Elvis back then was traveling with a doctor, and he would stay in hospital rooms in the most upstairs level with aluminum foil on the windows. So my girlfriend goes, hey, let's go check out the hospitals in the Washington, D.C. area and see if we can see where he's sleeping.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so my Elvis story, it's going to end like this. So my girlfriend gets back her film. And she was flashing pictures when the limousine came from under the garage.
Yeah.
I was just telling you about it. Perfect silhouette going through the tinted windows of his hairdo, collar, yeah, and everything.
Unbelievable. Wow. That's like her boldness. Story. She was great. She must have been a fun girlfriend.
Well, not for a while.
Hey, that's a great story,
that's my
Jim.
Story.
I love it.
Okay, bye.
Thanks. And to follow up, I don't know if anyone, we've had Rick Norcross on a couple times to talk about his press pass. Rick Norcross, Rick and the All-Star Ramblers. And if you haven't checked this out, he was, before he was really rocking, he was working for the Tampa Times, I think it was, and would cover all the rock shows and take pictures, and he's got some great photos of Elvis. It was one of the first shows that Elvis did after those years in Vegas, and it's down in Tampa. But check out Rick Norcross's press pass. You'll find some great stuff there. Great story, Jim. Wow. I don't have an Elvis story other than I think I told it the other day that a radio station I worked at, we bought a chainsaw art Elvis, and maybe I didn't tell this. we took it through Cincinnati. We'd stop at places like a abandoned gas station for people to come and see it, and then we had it at the station. It was probably about 7 foot high. We raised money, listeners and the morning show, we put money together and bought it from this guy. Had it out in his yard. Eventually the termites got to it, but, for a while it was a fun thing to have. All right, let's talk about some more cheeses. I was at the Vermont Cheese Summit over the weekend on Sunday. It was at Shelburne Farms. And you forget some, and some you never heard of or, haven't tried much of. But there are some that are really historic, and if you go down to Plymouth to the Calvin Coolidge home, there's a cheese manufacturer there. It's called Plymouth Artisan Cheese. I visited when they first opened up, but this was run by Coolidge's father and then by, I think, maybe his son. Coolidge did not make cheese himself there in Plymouth, but Plymouth Artisan Cheese started with this one specific kind of granular cheddar recipe that was from back in the day. And now they've expanded to about 10 different types of cheeses. They're doing a great job. There is cheese being made at Hildene. That's the Lincoln family home in Manchester. And we've got to get that cheesemaker on. And then there's one called Crowley Cheese, which can this can draw like its history back. I think it's the oldest cheesemaker in America still going. It's like 200 years old, and it's here in Vermont. That's Crowley. Of course, some of the big ones were there. Cabot, which they're making some great butters as well. Shelburne Farms makes their own cheeses. And then Vermont Creamery, which has gone to all goat's milk. And they have a beautiful butter as well. And they're coming out with some exciting stuff, some flavored cheeses that you'll really enjoy, even like for a dessert offering. And a few others I met there that I hope to have on the show in the weeks ahead. Cobb Hill, which our friends from Farm to Cheese mentioned. Parish Hill, which several years back was one of like three or four creameries in the country that created a new style of cheese. You know, so like cheddar and blue and all these have long histories, but these cheesemakers got together and used different cultures and different processes or whatever to create a new style of cheese. That's Parish Hill. That's down, I think, Brattleboro way. And another one that I hope to have on, Springbrook, is in Reading, and they've got an interesting story, too, of how they've brought kids from the inner city up here for years and, you know, give them an understanding of farming, but then they started making cheese as kind of an outlet, and so the kids get to see that process as well. Anyway, we live in a wonderful place is what I probably keep saying by not saying it every single day here on this show with the people that you get to hear. Okay, Danny, it is time to use all your might to push back against the torrent of phone calls to shut the phones down after another exciting edition of Open Phones. Open Phones Now with his very own special theme music performed by Bill LaBeouf and the Bold Vikings, stealing the music and vocal styling of Debbie Harry and Blondie. You might remember the drummer in Blondie, Clem Burke. I think he's still around. One of the greatest drummers who never gets a mention. Check them out. All right, let's head to CBS News. Then we'll head to Townsend and the Big Picture Farm. Coming up at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. One thing I think I know about the owners of Big Picture Farm in Townsend, they love their kids and their grown-up goats as well. As a matter of fact, it seems the goats are having a great time on the farm, and in kind, they produce the wonderful milk that eventually becomes Big Picture Farm's cheese and chocolate and caramels. And then their lovely images grace a number of different products. It's time to learn all about the goats, the products, and the operation of Big Picture Farm. Joining me now is one of the owners, Louisa Conrad. Louisa, thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Louisa about Big Picture Farm and or about those goats, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Cliche, I know, but give us the big picture of your farm there in Townsend.
Yeah, so we moved here 12 years ago to work on a sheep dairy and make their sheep cheese and look after their sheep. And as part of the deal, we were allowed to bring three goats, and goats could live in the old chicken coop, and they'd give us one of their donkeys for protection. And from there, we've grown, bought the farm in bits and pieces by going back to the bank again and again as our business grew. And we now have 55 goats, and we sell our caramels and chocolates to over 1,300 stores across the country.
Wow.
And yeah, we still love what we do.
How many donkeys protecting those 55 goats now?
So we've switched out donkeys for, we have two Maremmas, which are sort of ancient guard dogs. They're originally from Italy. A lot of people think they're Great Pyrenees. They look a lot like them. They're just sort of the Italian version. We have a lot of coyote pressure on our hills. So the donkeys, and there was actually a llama at one point, really weren't cutting it. And Maremmas are incredible creatures. They are not they're not easy dogs in the sense that they do what they want when they want. They have been sort of trained for thousands of years to be independent thinkers. So they'll sort of look at you when you want them to do something and say, well, that's an interesting idea, but I have a different one. We have not lost a goat, knock on wood, since they've been here, which is about 10 years. And they also protect our farm. Like, we don't even lock our chickens in. Don't tell all the foxes out there. But, they keep everything away.
Okay. Had you had a background in agriculture before you came to the sheep farm and started working there?
No, I grew, yes, before we came here, we've been working at Blue Ledge Farm in Addison County, helping them milk their goats and make their cheese. But before that, we were novices in farmland. My husband comes from a line of potato farmers in northern Maine, and they like to say farming skips a generation. In his case, it did. I came from Manhattan, so no. I'd been in Vermont for about 10 years before that, but there was no farming blood in my lineage.
And your husband, Lucas Farrell. Now, how does somebody from Manhattan then become comfortable with farming? It's not the easiest transition in the world.
No. And it was definitely my husband leading the way on that one. I was enmeshed in an art career, teaching, and but the goats got his soul, and that's what he wanted to do. So we went forward. And I'll say there's a lot about our farm that, has been possible because of the Internet. In addition to sort of reaching out to our elders in the Vermont farming community, there's a lot of, like goat forums where you'd sort of find out, okay, this is wrong with my goat, what do I do now? Yeah. Or, relying on a lot of that kind of knowledge. And also, part of a farm is keeping your animals healthy and happy, but it's also just a ton of machines that operate and break all the time. Yeah. And for that, YouTube videos are really critical to be able to figure out how to fix things.
Incredible.
And my husband's become quite adept at fixing everything because of YouTube.
Well done. Now, on a lot of what you have on the Internet, on your webpage, on your materials, even on some of your chocolates, there are these beautiful images of your goats, lovely line drawings. Who captured those?
Thank you. That's my role on the farm, or one of my roles. And it's definitely super fun to be able to have such a good subject matter. And that was sort of one of the plays on the name of Big Picture, is that we wanted to keep enmeshed in our creative lives and tell the story of goats. Once we sort of became enraptured with goats, it was we wanted to share their stories and their individuality and personalities and playfulness, and sort of deliver a product that was, it's often given as a gift with sort of a narrative intact. And so it's a lot of fun to draw them and go from there.
And tell us about the personalities of goats, because until you go out to a goat farm, I don't think you ever really understand what they're like. And I've had the opportunity to see them, and they are so playful.
Yeah, goats are really the best, and I encourage everyone to go to a goat farm and hang out. We offer goat hangouts
that
people can sign up for, where it's just, you just come to the farm and you basically, just hang out with the goats and give them rubs, and they'll rub you right back. Goats are, people always are surprised by how friendly they are and how personable, and, people are really like, oh, they're almost like my dog. And they are much more in tune with humans than, say, like a sheep, that want, in my experience, a lot less to do with you. The goats are very friendly, very curious, and part of that is what gives them their sort of bad name for getting into anything. But, they really want to engage, and they also just have unique personalities. Well, one of the things that has been really rewarding for us is, we keep all the babies and the moms, and you have these puddles of multi-generational goats hanging out together. And there's characteristics that really run within each family. You know, one of our original goats was named Gertrude Stein, and then she had a daughter named Cy Twombly and Eva Hess. They're all artists, named after artists, Laura Owens. And they're all super, like, all of the goats always stay in a pack except for this one line of goats that's always just sort of like, we're doing our own thing.
Wow.
And then there's another line of goats that's always going to be the goat that is on their tippy toes, just climbing way up high for that tallest, you know, the most for out of reach leaf on the tree.
Oh my.
So they sort of all, you know, they all have their own little quirks that they have, and it's fun to watch.
Well, one thing I've learned this morning about barnyard animals: goats are like dogs, sheep are like cats. So, right? All right. So, Louisa, since I got to sample your caramels, let's begin there. They were so creamy and delicious. Tell us how you create these wonderful candies.
Yeah, so goat's milk is wonderfully suited for caramel in particular. It makes a really velvety, lush caramel, and that's in part just based on the chemical composition of the milk. The fatty acid chains in goat milk are shorter than in cow milk, which is one of the reasons why it's easier for people to digest than cow milk. But it also means that the way it breaks down when it cooks into a caramel makes it sort of smoother, more viscous than a cow milk. And So to make the caramels, basically, first you have to start with the happiest animals. So all of our farm is animal welfare approved, and the goats are out on pasture for as long as grass is growing in Vermont. And then, yeah, we boil the milk with organic sugar and other organic flavorings. Local, we use, you know, Putney Mountain wine to add a lot of flavor to, you know, like the raspberry rhubarb. We use their rhubarb blush wine. And then for our apple cider, we use their Vermont Pomot. We also use, you know, some Mad River Distilleries bourbon for our brown butter bourbon. We use Vermont chai for our chai. And, you know, our neighbors down the hill boil some syrup for us for the maple. So we feel really lucky about living in a state with so many interesting flavors to add to the milk. And yeah, it's about a 3-hour cook, and then we have a tray of caramels.
They are delicious. You mentioned something, and I do not want to ignore it. You mentioned that you are animal welfare approved. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so it's something that's extremely important to us, and it's the highest certification for animal welfare in the country. And it means that our goats are outside and on pasture, you know, as often as the grass is growing. It also means that, you know, in the wintertime they have all the space and are still free roaming. And, in fact, you know, they have things like, you know, making sure that for goats there's, you know, like jungle gyms for them to climb on. So in our case, we have large rock walls that serve that purpose in our barnyard. It also, you know, it means you're taking care of all of the animals from a health perspective and keeping track records of where your animals, you know, come from, where they go, all that. So it's really rigorous. They come and audit our farm every year to make sure we're up to standard. And so we're really proud of that certification.
Let's stay in the sweets realm, Louisa. What types of chocolates do you offer?
Yeah, so we have a variety of chocolates. Not surprisingly, most of them feature our goat's milk caramel. So the one we sell wholesale that you'll see around stores around the state are our chocolate-covered goat milk caramels. And what's cool about that is that it's our sort of best-selling sea salt vanilla caramel enrobed in organic dark chocolate. And then on top of all of them are all of the line drawings of all of the little goat faces. So when you buy a box of chocolates, you get all the chocolates, and then you get a little booklet that has a, you know, an image of the drawing, and then tells you a little anecdote about which goat drawing is on that picture. So you get a little hint into sort of the multitudes of personalities and quirks of the beloved creature.
That's beautiful. Now, I would imagine that chocolatiering and caramel making are a bit different. So how did you perfect the chocolate side?
Yeah, so it's taken us, it's been a, you know, a slow evolution of our business, you know, from when we started and I was cooking caramel in a pot. We then moved to the cotton mill in Brattleboro. They really helped incubate our business while before we owned the barn on the farm. And once we owned the farm, we built out our creamery and eventually sort of diversified into chocolate and just a lot of trial and error and experimentation. And I feel like, you know, we have the chocolate covered caramels down pat, and then seasonally we also offer up a lot of sort of special treats. One of our bestsellers are our goat turtles, which is, you know, cashews, caramel, and chocolate. They're all sort of painted up fancy like a little turtle. We also make a goat Trix bar, which is sort of a riff on a Twix bar, and it's a shortbread made with goat butter and a layer of caramel enrobed in chocolate. We also have a line of chocolate truffles that are made with our goat milk as well as our honey from the bees on the farm, and it just makes a beautiful ganache that we enrobe, and sometimes we'll do sort of special flavors of that according to the season.
Now, on to the cheese. So you talked about goat's milk, you know, the qualities that make it good for the caramels. What does goat milk provide to cheeses compared to cow's milk?
Yeah, so, I mean, goat cheese, so I fell in love with goat cheese when I was a tiny person and have been in love ever since. And that's really what drew us actually into farming in the first place. I was like, let's buy, we had, it was 2008, the economy had tanked, and, you know, our jobs were looking a little iffy. So we're like, we're going to just take some time and do something fun and learn how to make goat cheese. And I emailed this Greg and Hannah at Blue Ledge, and they took us on. And goat milk just makes delicious cheese. And for us, we make a cave-aged raw milk cheese with a natural rind. We make our cheeses in really small batches. So yeah, the best place to find it is at the Brattleboro Food Co-op, and we'll start selling it online in October.
Now, tell us about the Sonnet cheese that you make. It won an award that it garnered back in 2014, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and yeah, we actually haven't entered it since then just because our production schedule on the cheese is a little tricky because we only make cheese from May until September, and all of the awards are in the summer, and so our cheese, it takes 3 months to age, which gives it a really nutty, nice complexity to it. And so the Sonnet is originally based off of what the former owners of the farm, they made a manchego with their sheep's milk, and so this is sort of an alteration of that to accommodate the goat milk, which isn't quite as fatty as the sheep milk, but it's a, it's sort of a nutty cheese, you know, a lot of like acorn kind of flavor, and yeah, it pairs beautifully with like a plum jam preserve. And it grates really nicely, you know, like on top of a pasta or a, even a salad. It just adds a lot of interesting notes to your dish.
I'm in cheese heaven right now. Another of your cheeses is Haiku. So in 17 syllables, 575, please tell us about. All right, I'm being a jerk. You can wax rhapsodic about this cheese using as many syllables and stanzas as you'd like. Tell us about Haiku.
Yeah, well, so a little bit about the name Haiku and Sonnet. You know, my husband is a poet. He had a book of poems out last year, and so, you know, it was kind of like, well, we didn't have time to make art or write poems, but at least we were making cheese named after them.
Nice.
But, yeah, the Haiku is definitely a labor of love that we've been working on and improving every year. And I have to say, I think it's the most delicious it's ever been. It's just a little softer and more supple than the Sonnet. It has a little more bounce to it, a little more creaminess. We let the curds, we don't cut them quite as small, so they retain a little bit more moisture in the process.
And any other cheeses that you're making?
Those are the only two we sell commercially. Yeah, we you know, always, I'm a big fan of just always having Chev and that kind of thing in the kitchen, but that's because it's raw milk and not aged. It's just for us, sadly.
So you mentioned that, you know, you make them from May till September. When will we see Big Picture Farm cheeses at the co-op in Brattleboro right now, or are we just ahead of the curve?
Yeah, so they hit the shelves of Brattleboro a couple weeks ago, and they'll continue being there through the fall as well as online starting in September.
Oh, fantastic.
Yep.
And you have had this variety of products, incredible variety. You started a family. So how do you and Lucas do it all?
We have really good help. so that's been critical. And, you know, we've just kind of grown really organically from as we've gone. And, you know, we didn't have kids for the first 7 or so years of our business, which allowed us to work, you know, 80 hours a week as one does, and go from there. Now that we have kids, we definitely rely on our help much more because there's a time limit to what their patience is and how much they need us around.
Sure.
But we also feel so lucky to, you know, to live on a farm. Sometimes I'm like, this is just nuts what we're doing. but then I see my girls playing with the goats and feeding the chickens, and I'm like, oh, but this is also why we do what we do, and feel really lucky for them to be able to be growing up on a farm the way they do.
Yeah. I want to backtrack. We've got about a minute left to something you mentioned earlier, and that is the goat hangouts. I think people should know more about this. Tell us, people have to kind of go online, book a time to come and hang out with a goat, and what do they do? What do they get out of it?
Yeah, so people come. I highly encourage you to check out bigpicturefarm.com, the Visit Us page. We also have a few Airbnbs if people want to come and have a farm stay and hear the roosters crowing early in the morning and get the whole experience. But the goat hangouts are meant to just come and meet some goats. And you also get to meet the pigs and the chickens and the cats and the dogs and get the whole experience. But mostly you just get to really up close nuzzle a goat and have that little bit of goat magic wear off on you.
I love it. And Louisa, this Friday on our show from 9 to 10, we're going to talk about agritourism, something cool. Obviously, yeah, that you're doing there at Big Picture Farm. Louisa Conrad owns the Big Picture Farm in Townsend with Lucas Farrell. To learn more about what they do, how to order some of their goodness, and, of course, to schedule a goat hangout, you can visit bigpicturefarm.com. Louisa, thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rick. Really appreciate it.
All right, and give our best to the goats.
Yeah, will do. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivigan. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Common Sense Radio with Bill Serra is up next. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we visit the Sculpture School in Waitsfield and the Bundy Modern in Warren.